Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Who knew John Hughes could get so damn deadly? It's a Breakfast Club episode that not everyone survives. Taylor Hickson, who plays Petra, co-showrunner and executive producer Rick Remender, both stop by. It's all coming up.
Hello and welcome to the official Deadly Class podcast presented by Sci-Fi Wire. I am your co-host, Max Tadaldi, and I am joined by
Jackie Jennings.
We did it at the same time.
Oh, the other co-host. the other co-host.
And we are here to talk about Deadly Class episode 4.
Mirror People.
Ooh.
That was my deep voice.
It was really deep, yeah.
I actually have a surprisingly deep voice for my stature, I think.
You talk about yourself like you are a foot tall.
5'3", on a good day, mostly 5'4", if I'm on my tippy toes.
5'4", if I'm on my tippy
toes. That's
bless.
Only because you're like 6'3", Jackie.
Absolutely not.
I feel like we've also created these personas of ourselves. We are both very much average-heighted people, I think.
Yeah. I do often when I'm interviewing, when I interview particularly, I'll say female celebrities, I do feel like the Khloe Kardashian where I'm like, I'm not big, they're 5'1". Like, I'm 6 inches taller than everyone in the entire cast of The Magicians.
Let's take a moment to unpack this. We haven't been in Shabnam's house for a full episode.
Yeah.
All right. So, but who knows what was happening in episode 3? Who knows how much time has elapsed?
Yeah.
And not only has Shabnam not cleaned up, that house is a pit.
It's horrible.
But this dude who has just been hanging out since
living
then,
there.
What is going on? It's very creepy.
Yeah.
But I guess if you have that house at your disposal, you risky business it.
Yeah.
I mean, that just feels like it goes without saying.
Yeah, you run around in your underwear until they come home, I guess. it's so odd.
This amazing phone call with his parents or his mom. He's basically like relaying all of the events that have transpired to him at this house. And then his bro shows up and we realize everything's connected. Fuckface and Shandy are bros.
Yeah.
Which, again, is
makes
crazy.
Sense.
So if you forget what happened in this episode of Deadly Class, here is the recap of episode 4, Mirror People.
I'm calling that school first thing tomorrow.
What school?
My cousins. I didn't exactly leave Tokyo on good terms.
No one's sweet on Chico.
I thought you two...
I need a passport. This is my chance to get away from him.
My dad owes the mob like $1 million.
My mom, my brother, they're not going to survive him.
What can we do?
Take a road trip to Vegas to kill my dad.
All right, so episode 4.
Yeah.
Beginning with a bang in Shabnam's parents' house with Brian Posehn, who plays Shandy, having a little risky business moment.
Yeah. I think it's really cool that Brian Posehn is in the show at all.
It's amazing. And it's also, I think, another one of those subversions of those 80s tropes. This dude's creepy. He's way past high school age. He's got a big old gut, a distracting belly button. It was actually distracting for me. I could not pay
attention. I don't remember it.
It was all I could really focus on, apart because there was the sweet dance moves. There was the amazing Iron Maiden song that he's rocking out to. But I was just hypnotized by this man's...
Is it big?
It's an Audi. It's for sure an Audi.
Oh.
It's taken up some real estate.
Interesting.
But it's a thing of beauty.
I'm not 1,000% clear on what belly buttons are or why we're not more scared of them. Because it is a scar, right? Like, it's essentially a scar. It was once a portal directly into your stomach.
It was basically your mouth in the womb. That's like, that's what was feeding you.
Fuck.
Yeah, that was a tough analogy. Sorry about that.
It's true, though.
But it's also, so I think for me, so I have a twin brother, right?
What?
An identical twin brother.
You cannot, episode 4, drop.
Drop a knowledge
identical
bomb all over the place.
So what's his name?
Luke. His name is Luke.
Okay, so your parents didn't go for the, like, Max and Sax. I don't know what.
Sax is definitely not a real name, but that's
no.
fine.
Saxophone.
But I feel like it's still, they got the same cadence, right? It's Max Tidaldi, Luke Tidaldi.
Yes, one right? Monosyllabic. Yeah, very, okay.
All right, so we both have any belly buttons, right?
Okay.
So now, fast forward 3 years later, my younger brother is born. Jude Tidaldi, also with the cadence.
Cool name.
Yeah, cool name. But he's got kind of like an Audi-ish belly button. It's not completely Audi. And so growing up as a kid, you focus on each other's differences. And it's, I think since then, I've just been super attuned to people's belly buttons.
Okay.
And I think Brian Posehn has a magnificent mountainous belly button. I think it's the right. Yeah, I know. I need some work on my adjectives today.
Do you guys ever switch places?
We did a couple times in high school.
Cool.
But really just to mess with teachers. Nothing nothing untoward.
Okay.
Yeah. We were well behaved kids.
Yeah. Okay.
I think people's brains immediately go to like, oh, did you switch on like your girlfriends and stuff? And I'm like, no, joke's on you. I didn't have a girlfriend in high school. So
no. And neither did he.
So this was one of the most painful parts of my childhood. I guess that's still technically. My brother had his first like real girlfriend sophomore year in high school. No girlfriend for me. And then a like serious girlfriend senior year. I did not. I was on the sideline, and I was like, put me in, coach. I am available.
Yeah, hello.
Ready to play this game.
The exact same. We're the no offense, same person. You have the same DNA.
It was someone pressed Control-C, Control-V.
Copy-paste.
In the womb.
And that someone was God, starring Jennifer Garner. Sounds like a fucking...
I would love to see Jennifer Garner as...
I asked God for twins.
As God. That's what you want, her, that voice, that sort of a...
She's so sweet.
That sweet, sweet voice. No, yeah. Screw Morgan Freeman as God.
No.
Who needs him?
Jennifer Garner anyway.
You've got Jennifer Garner.
Okay, so wow, identical twin.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew?
So Brian Posehn...
Yeah, very cool that he's in it.
Dancing around.
So this risky business moment is one of many, even within this episode, of references to 80s pop culture. I mean, this whole episode is... Is it an homage? I don't know.
I feel like it's straight up Breakfast Club. It's their love letter. It's their
but is it a love letter? I was going to say, I think that the show, something I'm trying to wrap my head around and see exactly where the perspective of the creators is landing is it feels very much the characters espouse this like anti-pop culture. We don't like these things. John Hughes sucks. But then the show itself does an entire episode that uses The Breakfast Club as a template only to upend it.
Oh, there's for sure some subversion going on. And I think, you know, with last week's episode with the Carrie reference and that whole setup with Petra's humiliation at the dance. And then this week's episode being very much a Breakfast Club homage or hate letter, love letter, whatever you want to call it. So, yeah, we saw that in episode 3 with Petra basically getting carried at the school dance. This episode is, you know, a very powerful homage to The Breakfast Club.
Yeah, the show has a really complicated relationship with 80s pop culture because you can't be referencing all of these iconic 80s movies and moments without there being some love, some respect there. But at the same time, it feels like they want to burn it all to the ground, kind of. So we spoke with Rick earlier in the week to get his take on John Hughes' version of the 80s and how Deadly Class is looking to subvert it.
The show definitely has a complicated relationship with 80s, specifically pop culture. 80s movies, John Hughes gets in both the comic and the show mentioned a lot. Can you just talk a little bit about the love-hate relationship with pop culture and the moments when you guys choose to pay complicated homage to it with the Risky Business and the Breakfast Club moments?
Sure. Starting with the Risky Business thing, that is an iconic and memorable bit of business there. We loved the idea of Dwight Shandy, you know, he's still living in Shabnam's house, that after the party he just became a squatter there. And it all really tickled us. And so when we cooked up him doing the risky business, that was fun. And it, you know, Brian being a huge metalhead and Dwight being a, you know, the sort of personification of that, doing it to Iron Maiden made us all very, very happy. And then it was, you know, sitting around with Miles and figuring out what the B side of that is, where you then have Dwight sort of doing a dissection of the movie and aspects of it that didn't make any sense, like the idea that we're rooting for a kid who's trying to turn his parents' house into a brothel because he broke their Fabergé egg or whatever the plot is about, you know, like, it's pretty ridiculous, right? And so you get kind of your cake, you get to do the homage, and then you still get to, like, sort of kick the tires a little bit.
Did you call it a B-side? That's like the B-side of the risky business moment is dissecting it and being like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool.
It's, you know, yeah. So you get the B-side on it. And I think that then with the Breakfast Club homage, it's a very iconic film. It's red meat. It's low hanging fruit. It's Generation X is never going to shake it off. People are always going to remember it as sort of the teen movie of the 80s, even though personally I think Better Off Dead is vastly superior and more sort of representational of my generation. That is just a matter of doing something that structurally is we were going to do the detention episode, and when we were breaking that stuff, I had gone through my notes and I found like, I had written a note in the book that I never got to do around here, which was that the Kuroki Syndicate come to the school. And then I grabbed the Kamiga brothers, who are characters that we don't really see in the book for a couple little whiles, but pulled them up forward. And then we all sat around and hammered it into the Breakfast Club format. And it's fun, you know, like I just watched, you know, Ferris Bueller's Day Off with my kids. You know, one of the things I did when I was getting ready to, you know, open the writer's room was I rewatched, I think, 20 different teen movies from the 80s to try to capture different tropes and different tones and different storytelling techniques and sensibilities that we could then incorporate into the show, so that it had a lot of love letters and homage to these various films. So it was like sort of a natural fit that, you know, taking something like The Breakfast Club and then mixing it with a Yakuza attack on the school just sort of tickled us all, and so off we went.
Yeah, it's awesome. I think in Jackie and my dissection of the show, those are the moments that really resonated with us the most, where it's, you've got this, you know, very like authentic teenage conversation, and then all of a sudden, you know, assassins are breaking through and chopping off people's hands.
Yeah. It's all temporary. Which is, all of this fleeting, joy is very temporary.
Fleeting, might say. So one of the really strongest memories I have of the comic is that first moment that we meet Billy. And essentially the first thing he says is, fuck John Hughes, right? That's how you meet that character. And it feels really, it just showcases Rick and Miles' relationship with that era, that brand, that style of movie that really, I think, represented a generation and misrepresented, I think, a lot of people, particularly Rick. And it's just really interesting seeing that now manifest in the show, particularly with this episode, which is, you know, straight up The Breakfast Club. They are all in detention for whatever reason.
Yeah.
No matter how trumped up it is.
Yeah, we start with Risky Business, and then the bulk, the majority of the episode is everybody in detention because of the dance, because of the poisoned darts at the dance.
Although I don't think that was everyone, because that's the...
It wasn't everyone.
Everyone's sitting down. I was like, wait, why are all these people here? Why is Chico there?
Yeah.
Who knows? Why is Jaden there?
Oh, Jaden.
Maybe that mousetrap that he laid on Billy, potentially.
I guess.
And, I mean, Marcus even brings it up. He's like, Sia, why are you here? And Sia's like, you know, I vouched for you. Because you did this to me.
I loved that moment, by the way. This is a tangent. Because I felt like you could really see in Benjamin's face... He thinks there's nothing worse than thinking you're flirting with someone and having them be like, ew. And you're like, I thought it was mutual. And you think I'm a moron.
It's so good.
Feels very bad.
Because he's picking the lock. He's being really smooth. He's like, it's so obvious you want to just have babies with me. And she's like, or you're my pledge and I don't give a shit about you. I have to be here.
Yeah. And it's not a cutesy thing of her being like, no, I don't even want to. It's a real reason.
She's not flirting back.
You think I would be here? I would be in detention.
My sword was taken from me. There are no snacks.
None.
Which I feel like is way worse than the sword. No Ruffles, no Lay's.
Yeah.
No Doritos, no Pringles.
None.
I could go on.
And I think where it lands and where the creators probably want us to land is, here's what all of that stuff would look like grounded in a reality that looks a lot more like actual reality and not just this like fluffy outside of Chicago suburbs, white bread kind of reality that John Hughes is playing in, which is like fun for its own purposes. But I think they really want the show to be grounded in like a violent institutions or corrupt reality.
Yeah. I think that's ultimately the strongest aspect of this show is juxtaposing those super hyper stylized, hyper violent assassin moments. You know, the Yakuza just show up and they're killing people left and right.
Yeah.
Compared with those more intimate, realistic moments, the personalities, being a teenager and dealing with an abusive family, dealing with a first crush.
Yeah.
Those moments really ring authentically to the teenage experience. And then it's like all of a sudden you are lurched out of that and in a San Francisco assassinationville environment, which is totally crazy. So Jaden in this episode, which is, first of all, not a name that existed in 1987. Let's call that out.
He might be the first Jaden.
Jaden Smith was the first Jaden.
It's true.
This is, I feel like, commonly
it's known. A newer name.
Knowledge. That is such a newer name. I feel like in 1987, it would be Jay or Jason.
JJ.
Sure. JJ Abrams. Great example.
Yeah.
Jaden, not a real name. So you know he's going to die.
Well, he also, to me, felt like he was the red shirt of this episode. Like, he got sent down to Planet Detention with all of the people you do know. So I bet he's dead.
You're scoping him out right in the beginning. He dead.
Yeah, he's done.
But he also had some really great moments leading up to his untimely demise. One of my absolute favorite moments from this episode is where Marcus and Saya are having this somewhat heartfelt moment in the contraband room.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, all these Marcusisms where he's so, so moody and he's just feeling all the feelings.
Yeah.
And he's like, misery loves company, but company doesn't care much for misery.
Woof.
And it's like in your mind, that sounds smart and poetic and truthful. But Jaden just looks over and he's like, dude, are you retarded?
Yeah.
Like, that's not something that you say to people.
Not a word we're using again anymore today, Jaden.
No, we're not using that again. That was one time only offer.
Yeah. No, I just meant in general in culture. But him just cutting him off and what is this? What is this nonsense?
He rode a cheese dragon through a forest of delicious sweets. I felt like we really got to know Jaden a little bit, and he might have been a one-trick pony. That's fine. You know, he's kind of like, I guess, the stoner rat. Is he a rat? You kind of assume so.
No. When I believe in the first episode, he's introduced as being part of like the D&D kids.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure he's at that table.
There's a D&D posse here?
Yeah.
What?
I forget what they called them, but.
The Hessians?
Is it the Hessians? Yeah.
The Hessians, the ones that have all the drugs?
Yes.
Got it.
He is at that table. I don't know
there's a D&D syndicate, and how do I get access to this?
You just ask. This is it.
It is not exclusive.
No, they're mostly nice. You just ask. Yeah, the way I remember it is because in the screener copies we're watching, he did something and it says like, insert Jaden audio.
You're like, so like, that's what his name is.
He's Jaden. That scene is really fun. Victor continues to be very complicated for me because he's really funny. Talking about RoboCop, him and Chico, so funny.
A good little moment.
Yeah. He's really funny. He seems like he could be a good time. Too bad. He's so mean.
But,
I don't know.
But he also has, again, this back and forth thing with Petra where they flirt, they tease, and in this episode in particular, they have a real moment. And honestly, like, all of the walls are down. They are on the floor dying together.
They think in their minds, it's solid chance they're both dead.
They're dead.
Yeah.
And Petra completely opens up to him even after the betrayal, which I thought was really goes to show her character, her sensitivity.
Yeah.
And Victor is receptive to that. He's open.
he's open. I thought this scene was really well done because you want it. What I wanted the whole time was some kind of like confession, like I'm sorry, or, you know, I actually really, from either her or him.
Yeah.
And it's almost above that in a way where they're so mature and have seen so much.
They've moved on.
Yeah. Like he, it's really sad. Like he confesses like he's a 95-year-old man dying and he's, what, 17? He's like, I've done some horrible things. You're like, oh my God.
Really? Okay. I don't know. Like a, not that, it can't be that bad.
I don't think it'd be pretty bad.
Yeah. I guess at a school for assassins.
Yeah.
Potentially.
I love that scene.
Yeah. And we spoke with Taylor Hickson, who plays Petra, about the Victor and Petra dynamic. And it was great hearing from right from the source about that relationship.
Something that struck me throughout the series is that Petra is a much bigger character and the Petra, Victor, Billy kind of arcs are way bigger than they were in the comics, which she's my favorite character. So I'm very excited about it. But did they ever talk about like why that choice was made? Why, I guess.
I'm not sure that it was their initial decision to have Petra so prominent, but I think basing it off the pilot, I think they just tested out a lot of the characters and which ones I think had likability. And I think they said they wanted to see more of the graveyard characters and, you know, more of the characters that seem sort of in the background throughout the comic. I think audiences wanted to see them come to life and have more story on screen. I'm really glad to see it because the character development's incredible.
Yeah, it's really good. Cool. So I would have been like, I would have fit right in that test, in that focus group. I'd be like, yeah.
Yeah, sign me up, more Petra. Yeah, let's do it. So I don't want to blow up Jackie's spot, but I actually am going to blow up Jackie's spot. Because in this week's podcast, this is a direct quote. He doesn't know if she's ever shipped anything as dangerous as Petra and Victor.
That makes it sound like I'm personally involved in...
You are very emotionally involved in this.
I'm deep, yeah.
I am so deep in this. And we just wanted to get your thoughts on the Petra-Victor relationship and also an analysis of Jackie's shipping of that relationship.
Yeah, like what's wrong with me?
Jackie, that's a very dangerous ship.
Yeah, it is.
I'd say an even more dangerous ship is Brandy and Petra, which Siobhan and I have been pitching to Rick, but ooh, it doesn't look like it's going anywhere.
Well, that's a miss on their part.
Yeah. Victor and Petra's relationship is very complicated. Whether she's using him to feel a part of a legacy or if he's afraid of his true feelings and he's working under Brandy. I'm with you, Jackie. This relationship pulls your heartstrings a lot of different ways. I think the best answer is just don't get too attached to any of the characters or the relationships because, you know, motor school and all that.
I'm going to throw in a dark horse contender for my ship.
Oh!
Which is Marcus and Chico. Hear me out.
Whoa!
Hear me out. In episode one,
okay,
right, Chico confronts Marcus and he like rams him into the locker. And then he's like, we've got a date after school.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Direct quote. Then Marcus is like checking out all of the cliques in the lunchroom. Chico looks at him and gives him a little like kissy face.
Right.
And it's like, wait, what's going on here? Then this whole episode, they're like basically flirting in the contraband room.
Yeah.
They've definitely got a thing going on. And two birds with one stone, it then frees up Chico from the abusive relationship with Maria. It's a win-win. I am all in on Charkus.
What? Charkus. Ew.
We're going to workshop that a little bit.
Vector and Charkus. Let's take a very cool, very counterculture commercial break.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, what's your secret? Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Yeah, this episode is really fun and light until it gets really heavy really fast.
Real
we
dark.
Get a student real dying. Mm-hmm. Victor and Petra, as far as we know, at the end of this episode, in what's it's actually serious is actually worse than critical condition, right? When you're in the hospital, yeah. Serious is the worst, I think.
Is it worse
than
critical?
Because I think it's counterintuitive. Like critical is,
but they're alive. They're not.
Worse.
They're not dead.
They're not dead, but okay. They're not in good shape. They're getting wheeled out. And then we also see this cool face off, this 3-2 of Saya, Marcus, Master Lin against the two Kuroki dudes.
Yeah. And I really loved this scene for a couple of reasons. But there have been several action sequences or big tentpole action sequences throughout the show. This was the first one where I was like, this is so badass. And I think part of it was just seeing the different fighting styles between when you can hone in on some one-on-ones and really break down fighting styles and see what they're all about. I just find that really satisfying.
Yeah.
So seeing Master Lin grab the sword, mm-hmm. seeing this Kuroki Syndicate guy with like these Raphael style Sai were really sweet. Saya finally reclaims her samurai sword, which was very badass. And then Marcus comes in with like a frying pan. He's scrappy as
hell. He's scrappy. Well, he did really well in the unconventional combat class.
That's right.
Right?
Oh, he aced that one.
Yeah. I think Marcus is also the dude who's like teeing other people up for the kill.
Yeah, for sure.
Like
some layups.
He is behind the dude so Saya can stab him, which this I actually will try not to spoil, but that the way that that was shot feels very much like a very important panel that is later in the comics.
Some foreshadowing.
This episode feels like the first time we see Saya.
That moment she kills her cousin.
Yeah, and pulls the mask off. And I love the way Lana Condor played it, where it's instant. It's not this kind of shock moment that I think you would usually get. It's this instant. Like, she probably knew who it was.
For sure. I maybe had like an inkling, but then the second the mask comes off, it's like my worst suspicions were confirmed. Mm-hmm. And totally agree with that. She nails that moment where it's like this flood of emotion and then she reins it in real quick.
Yeah.
It's like a couple tears and then, nope, I'm not going to let that affect me.
Yeah. Up until this point, Saya has been cool. I don't know
she
that
has
she's
been, cool.
been that has had that much depth. Like,
yeah.
Her character has been sort of only cool, which is fun, but we haven't gotten to see like conflict within her too much.
Yeah.
And this was the first time that you were like, oh, she's got a lot going on underneath this badass exterior.
You see this vulnerability to her.
Yeah.
So let's rewind a little bit to their past lives, right? So Marcus spent the first, 14, 15 years of his life on the streets. I mean, he, grew up with his parents, but he spent the last how many years on the streets?
Yeah.
Saya has spent her life being trained as a killer.
Yes.
Right. That has been her whole life experience, her like the goal of her family. So their exposures to actually a real relationship or any sort of romantic interaction, basically nil.
Yeah. They have no models for this.
Right. Yeah. And so we see Sai is great at like honeypotting Marcus, at thirst trapping him, at like luring him in.
Yeah.
But not necessarily great at, the emotional moment of an actual connection. Where is all of the smoothness coming from Marcus? He played that scene so freaking smoothly.
Yeah.
So it's like they touch hands, right? And he looks over at her. And I think in a typical teenage fashion, if you touched hands and got a look, you'd be going in for a makeout. You'd be going in for Frenchin', as the high schoolers talk it. But he
Frenchin' as the high schoolers talk it.
That came into my mind as a word that I hadn't used since maybe middle school.
Yeah.
Did you hear about Marcus and Saya on the rooftop?
It's
they were Frenching.
One of the worst.
Frenching and grinding. Bad. Let them die.
Frenching as a word is it's awful.
It is unforgivable. But he looks over at her and he doesn't go in. He holds it back.
Uh-huh.
He sees some vulnerability in that moment. Like, so he doesn't ruin it, which I feel like every single teenage boy in that moment would be like, I'm going in.
But he holds that like steady, unblinking eye contact,
flinching.
Like, whoa, so you smooth. You're a damn man. Like, what's going on?
Kid got game.
He's got game. I also think like if you've survived, not that I have ever been in this position, but if you've survived for years on the streets, you're probably pretty intuitive and pretty emotionally smart. You know how to read people. You know how to avoid trouble. You like,
yeah.
I think you're probably a pretty sensitive person. So it makes sensitive in the meaning like you can sense danger. You can sense opportunity. Intuitive.
Yeah.
There it is. I think it makes sense. Maybe not that Marcus is suave, but that he understands how not to overplay his hand.
So we get some awesome character building moments for mm-hmm. Saya and Marcus, which I thought were yep. really lovely.
Huge.
And then these little character vignettes that also I think did an amazing job of not only character building, but world building.
Yeah.
The first one being with Lin and Shu, his signif of
lover,
who I absolutely do not remember from the comic.
Yeah.
Which feels just like another moment that they are building out Lin as a sensitive and empathetic character.
Yeah, I really like this. I think they've done it throughout. And I really, really like the move to make all of King's Dominion unstable. It's yeah. not like, oh, the kids are the only ones questioning it. There's also adults at the top having that midlife crisis moment of, this isn't what I thought I was signing up for. Like, I'm sort of in the middle of whatever this journey is, and it's not what they told me it would be.
We also got an intro to Big Teddy Bear Willie.
Ugh.
What an angel this episode.
So good.
Just he basically swoops in and provides Maria with this passport. She was basically just like, can you do this? And he's like, yeah, I'll do it for you.
Yeah.
Because they're friends.
Well, and I think because he has sympathy, he says to her, how bad is it,
yeah.
Chico?
Yep.
And I think there's a part of Willie that you're in hell. So if I can get you a passport, fine. But you know that can't end well for
him. Oh, it's not going to end well. I know.
He's so kind.
And that's the amazing thing is that whenever he's around any of his gang in a big group, he acts so hard like he doesn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And then the second he's in these one-on-one moments, he's a big teddy bear.
Yeah. Ugh. And trusting.
Super trusting.
He never once.
That's also one of the things that I wonder about the show versus the comic, because part of, I think, the believability of these kids being in a school for assassins was seeing how hard everyone was,
yeah.
seeing how unfeeling, unsympathetic they were. And I'm wondering how sustainable that is for the show if they are layering all of these characters as sensitive beings at heart, and whether that,
well,
how that develops as the show goes on.
I don't know, though, that they, yeah. I don't think Chico is. I don't think Saya is. If one of the central questions of the show is like, do you have to lose your humanity? Like, mm-hmm. to get through this place, you have to lose your humanity. And I think people are going to land on one side or the other. I think Saya might land on the side of, like, self-preservation. I don't know.
But that's also an amazing moment in the final scene with Billy and Marcus. Because I think that is what, that's what Billy was wrestling with, is that he couldn't punch his dad. He couldn't be violent yeah. with his dad. And Marcus is like, you shouldn't feel bad about that. That just means you're not broken yet.
Yeah.
And then that obviously is subverted by Billy being like, let's go to Vegas and kill my
yeah.
dad.
Yeah. Let's get broken.
So that takes us to the end of episode 4. And mm-hmm. I've got to say, my loins are girded.
Jesus Christ.
They are girded. We've heard so much from all of the actors, from the producers about mm-hmm. this mythical episode 5. And for people that have read the comic, you know that we're going to Vegas, baby.
Yeah.
This is a thing. We're going to see some crazy drug trips. And
it's going to be crazy.
I'm so there for it. So
all the actors in separate interviews have yeah. referenced this episode 5 as being one of, if not their favorite.
So
if this episode were a person, I'd be grinding with it.
And Frenching.
I'd open-eyed French it. I haven't seen it
yet.
Oh,
nasty. But seems like something that you'd do.
Yeah.
All right. So let's do some deep dives. These are the moments when we paused the episode because we knew that something was up, and we had Rick Remender clarify some of our burning questions about the episode. So, episode 4, we see the name of the diner is Smile, TDB Diner.
Yeah, that's another front that leads into King's Dominion. There's the meat shop now, and now is one way to get into King's, and now we've established the Smile Diner. There's absolutely no hidden meaning behind the name of the diner.
Cool. So TDB isn't some crazy acronym.
No. In fact, I think that the diner was actually is just called the Smile Diner. But for the sake of this, I'll say yes. There's a deep, deep meaning.
Noted.
Keep looking.
In this episode, Willie is reading Grimjack number 26. Is there any particular reason he's reading that particular comic?
We originally had that as an Elektra comic, and it was tied into a few bits of business, and we're not allowed to show it. Marvel would not give us the okay. And so Miles is a fan of the Grimjack, and he pulled out an issue that he liked as a kid, and we ran with that.
Sweet. On the fridge in Billy's house, letters on the fridge spell out twat. Mm. Who made that?
I'm assuming that that's just an accident, because I don't believe anybody would actively go through and try to put in a dirty word like that into a television show.
Smart.
Must have been a lovely oversight. They would never.
And that is it for episode 4.
A hot one.
It was a hot one.
An 80s one.
A hot one.
A pop culture one.
Like 7 inches from the midday sun. Lyrics too smooth by Rob Santana. Wait, fuck. Rob Thomas and Santana. Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, we'll be back next week. You can check us out wherever you get your podcasts. And also, hey, tweet at me and Max if we missed something or you want us to ask a question of Miles or one of the cast members about episode 5.
We're responsive. We're friendly.
Yeah.
We'll listen to you.
As the kids say, slide into our DMs.